You're listening to the Electric Sheep Magazine podcast, a monthly podcast complementing the online periodical Electric Sheep Magazine. I'm Alex Fitch, and this month we're looking at the cinema and new technology. To coincide with the re-release of the classic punk film Repo Man on Blu-ray, I'm talking to director Alex Cox about his thoughts on the film now being available in the best quality you can experience it in since the original 35mm release. We're also discussing his thoughts on interactive cinema and his reasons for making the thematic sequel Repo Chick, which reunites half a dozen members of the original supporting cast. I'm also talking to Julian Napier, the director of Madame Butterfly 3D, the cinema release of a recent Royal Opera House production of Puccini's classic tale of spurned love in 19th century Nagasaki. To start off with, here's my interview with Alex.
Repo Man's a film that most people saw first on video or on pre-digital TV. And now that it's out on Blu-ray, I guess it's the first time that people can see Robbie Muller's cinematography in its full glory. Presumably that's something you've been looking forward to for many years.
Well, I guess that probably, yeah. I mean, probably this is the best it's looked since a new 35mm print, I would imagine. I mean, the new 35mm print would still be the best of all, but the Blu-ray disc is, you know, not a bad alternative if you don't have a 35mm projection room in your home. Yeah, and Robbie's work is really wonderful in the film, and it is great to see those. His lighting is so beautiful, and also those locations, those Los Angeles urban landscapes, you know, it's really, really fun. Looking nice.
In your book, X Films, you said that at the time of making Repo Man, you felt more like you were a writer who also directed, rather than a director. But the film does feel like it has notable directorial style, from your choice of the distinctive blue and white packaging for the comestibles, the framing of shots and the mise-en-scène. Looking back on it, do you feel that actually you were developing as a director and there were elements of Repo Man that were kind of Alex Cox, in inverted commas?
More in the script, I think. More in the script than in the mise-en-scène. I mean, the nice thing about it, I think the mise-en-scène is Robbie Moore.
Okay.
He had these opinions at the time, you know, like he didn't like to move the camera unless it was necessary. You know, he preferred medium shots to close-ups. He liked to play things in masters if it was possible. And I just kind of went along with Robbie's aesthetic, you know. Obviously later, I mean, everyone changes their aesthetic, and you think about Robbie's work on 24 Hour Party People or something where they're shooting it with like 20 little video cameras and completely different. I mean, the aesthetic, or his work for Lars von Trier, you know, I mean, it's completely different. But I think that was Robbie's aesthetic at the time. I think he brought that to the film, and possibly the hostility of the studio to the film, which was on many bases, including the music, the attitude, the characters, but also the somewhat austere style, in that it isn't very fast cut, and there aren't lots and lots of close-ups and cutaways and, you know, useless shots such as one encounters in the cinema of today. So I thought maybe you know that Robbie, you know, he has. I mean, although interestingly, a fair bit of Repo Man was created in post-production. We shot extra shots and reconstructed scenes and moved things around. And so there were two other cinematographers involved. Robert Richardson, who of course has become quite famous subsequently as the cinematographer of Oliver Stone and the Coen Brothers. But I think this was his first feature. And Tom Richmond, with whom I've worked many times since, and who shot Straight to Hell. So, but both of them, but I mean, their assignment was to do something in the Robin Muller style, and they did.
And when you talk about Repo Man and reading, you know, the chapter on it in X Films, it seems very obvious that getting to work with Robbie Muller, getting to work with Harry Dean Stanton, it meant that you were able to indulge your love of cinema as much as making a film yourself.
It's true, isn't it? And also those locations.
The
LA River and the historical, or the film historical significance of the LA River with the... where the giant ants lived, and where the assassination takes place in Point Blank, and I mean, it's really I mean, immediately after Repo Man, Robbie went and shot To Live and Die in L.A. for William Friedkin, and they shot a big shoot-em-up in the L.A. River, and then Drive has got a scene in the L.A. River where they race down it, you know, very similar to the little car race in Repo Man, and then they find this idyll, this sort of woody idyll in the L.A. River, which also exists. It's rich. It is filmically rich, and I think that's nice.
Yeah. Like that. And Repo Man, along with other films that you've directed, like Death and the Compass, The Revenger's Tragedy, Three Businessmen, they seem to be very much a meditation on man's relationship with the city. Do you think that's something that you've always been interested in, or did it start when you initially moved to LA?
No, I like the country the best.
Okay.
In almost all my films, they go out to the desert. I mean, not in Revenger's Tragedy, because I couldn't find a desert near Liverpool. In general, they go out to the desert, they end up in the desert, you know, that's where Three Businessmen end up, and that's where Straight to Hell takes place, and that's where Walker meets Vanderbilt, and that's where the Villa Tres Leroy is located in the Borges film. So I'm a desert, I'm really a desert guy. I'd rather be out in the desert or on the countryside.
Okay.
Or at the beach. But it's hard to shoot at the beach, because the beach, at least if it's a warm beach, it's very seductive, and it's very hard to keep your concentration if there's a warm, warm wave that's rolling.
Tenuously linking it, Death and the Compass, to Repo Man. I mean, there does seem to be a bit of a kind of a Borgesian narrative at play in Repo Man, that there are all these characters who are kind of like in search of that undefinable thing. And it's almost like the city has become the thing that keeps them down, that traps them from fully realizing their dreams.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, it's interesting. There was one shot I wish we could have done in Death and the Compass, which we didn't have the budget for, but I really wanted to have a big nighttime shot of this futuristic city interlaced with all of these freeways and overpasses, and to have all the freeways, all the roads, and all the overpasses full of police cars with their lights on, their flashing red and blue lights. So you really realize the city, it exists purely as an authoritarian exercise. It's entirely about domination and control, you know, and then of course the underside of the city, which is an entire criminal class, you know, arrayed against the forces of authority. So it's like this kind of two sets of teeth constantly gnashing on each other, you know. Somehow to get that across in one shot, that's the shot that isn't in there yet. One day.
So, I mean, because there are, for example, two different cuts of Death and the Compass, can you see yourself returning to your back catalogue? I mean, I suppose there's a director's cut of Straight to Hell coming out and remastering them, you know, adding new scenes.
This is the weird thing. I mean, Straight to Hell Returns have done fantastically over here in the States, and it's still playing theatrically.
Right.
You know, more than a year later. And the weird thing is, I mean, I've had no inquiry at all from the UK about Straight to Hell Returns.
Huh.
I sent a copy to the guy at the BBC, you know, who's bought some of my other stuff, and haven't heard back from him more than a year. And it's kind of weird, because I would have thought that... I tell you what I think it is. In the US, when Straight to Hell first came out, it was not liked. It was generally not liked by critics or by audiences. But over the years, certainly in the US, it's acquired a kind of a cult reputation. And Straight to Hell Returns, because it's got the digital violence and the extra scenes and extra music by Strummer and more of Courtney, you know, and more of Shane McGowan, it's kind of, you know, and, you know, a new sound design and a new visual aspect, because Tom Richmond went through it in like a completely changed the colour palette of the film. It's kind of like a new film. And yet, like Repo Man, it's also this trip down memory lane, because you get to see the Pogues and Strummer and Courtney when they were still youngish. And, you know, and Dennis and Grace Jones, you know. And so I think what hasn't happened in England is there hasn't you know, the critics haven't, and the audiences haven't come to terms with the fact that they were wrong about Straight to Hell. Straight to Hell is a really good film, you know, whereas the Americans have come around now to my way of seeing things.
And yeah, you know, if you read something like Sight and Sound, there's always such joy when a critic rediscovers a so-called film that slipped under the radar.
I know, but the thing was, they were so mad. There was two of the films that I made that really upset people, were Straight to Hell and Walker.
Right.
And the reaction was so strong. And then the reaction to Walker was even more intensely negative than the reaction to Straight to Hell. So I think it takes people a long time to come to Jesus, you know.
To admit they were wrong.
It just takes them a long time to realize they were wrong, and the filmmaker knew best, and they should have dug it at the time, you know.
Cool.
Not that I don't wish to, you know, I don't wish to see American Grandfather, of course, but I do think that. I think it's Straight to Hell, especially Walker, even more so, but Straight to Hell and Walker, I think they're very good films. And I just think it's a pity that, you know, again, in the US, Criterion have brought out this copy of Walker, which is just beautiful. It's a new print. It's got all these additional elements, a documentary about the making of the film, but only really in the context of Nicaragua at the time, the political context. Fascinating documentary by Terry Schwartz. And somehow the Americans have got—they've got around Walker too. They accept Walker all right now, you know. But the English, you know, take a little bit longer.
Well, hopefully that'll be the next one that Masters of Cinema bring out over here as well.
I wish they wouldn't bring out Walker. Actually, it'd be nice if they would, because I think it's only available on a vanilla DVD with no elements at all right now. There's such nice elements on the. On the Walker DVD. Oh, that's Criterion's a very good label, but Masters of Cinema are a very good label. So
indeed,
exactly right. They'd be the perfect people to bring it out.
Cool. Well, fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Cool. Oh, thank you very much.
And I must say, Masters of Cinema, the Blu-ray is the most complete version of Repo Man that there's ever been, or ever could be. Because it's also got the cleaned up television version.
Yeah.
You know, completely re-edited to take out all the swearing and all the drug use, and you know, and it's a completely different film. And they also have all the, you know, all the additional elements that we've made about Repo Man over the years. So it really is. But it's the only, as far as I know, it's the only edition of the film that's ever had the cleaned up television version where they say melon farmers.
I've got a real soft spot for melon farmers, I must say, as a swear word.
Isn't it great? And I think that was, although that expression has become, you know, heard frequently since then, but I think Dick Rude came up with that. Because he was on the soundstage trying to, you know, work with the actors, trying to come up with things they could say instead of rude words, you know. And so I think that Melon Farmers was invented by Dick Rude. Something has to change in the cinema. I mean, because of the... I mean, I don't mean stuff like 3D, you know. Or getting rid of film, or, you know, those are just, you know, fantasies of the studios, you know. But the idea that maybe film and games will have some kind of merge, or the film will be somewhat interactive. I know that's what Francis Coppola tried to do in this recent film that he's done. It's kind of like he has alternative scenes. So the idea is that he'll sit at the back screening the picture. And depending, he'll decide, okay, now we're going to have the happy bit, or now we're going to go in a sad direction, you know. And he'll change, you know, on at the end of the scene, he'll take you somewhere quite different depending on which screening you're at. I haven't seen the film, so I don't know how successful it is, but I think I think it's also got muddied by having 3D sequences as well, that probably it's become a bit, the 3D thing has overshadowed the alternate narrative aspect. So, are you familiar with the Italian Western, The Big Silence?
Yes, Corbucci, isn't it?
Yes, the Corbucci one. It ends very sadly, of course, with the death of the hero and the murdering of all the hostages. But Corbucci shot this alternative ending, which is completely happy, you know. Trantignon bounds in, blows away all the bad guys. He's wearing, like, the gauntlet of a suit of armour that he's got from somewhere, you know, which the bullets bounce off. absolutely absurd, and he saves everybody. But in a way that Corbucci was saying, okay, so for other territories that can't accept the unhappy and brilliant ending of my film, here's a happy ending, guys. So he was a kind of the master, Corbucci, of these possibilities. And I think maybe we'll do films like that in future. Maybe we'll start doing films with multiple endings or multiple narrative paths, which then maybe they'll play arbitrarily in the cinema and you can pick them at home, or maybe people will be electronically wired to the seats so that their emotions drive the movie. But I don't think that's very dangerous though, if we do that. But who knows what will happen?
Well, Joe Dante's most recent project, Splatter, that was an interactive TV miniseries where people could vote on what would happen in the next episode, and he shot two different versions of each, like, five-minute segment.
Oh, you see, exactly. So it's already happening. Yeah, exactly.
But it's funny that you should bring up computer games, because I was going to ask about Repo Chick, which seems to have kind of a computer game aesthetic to the backgrounds that you place the characters in front of.
Depending on which bit, because sometimes they're on a model railway layout, and sometimes they're in this game. So it just depends on what... I think it depends on what means of transport they're using. So in a game at the beginning, when they're in their cars, and then the cars segue to the model railway.
I mean, I know that, you know, you obviously were unable to get Waldo's Hawaiian Holiday made, but what made you want to do Repo Chick as a kind of belated thematic sequel as Repo Man? You know, was it just to get the cast back together and relive those heady days?
Well, the very interesting thing, through the good agencies of a guy who worked for the late Dino De Laurentiis at Universal, this guy was thinking, hey, you know, we can do a sequel to Repo Man, Universal, you know, and I'm going, well, you know, I probably can, you know, and so we tried to get it going with them, but again, this is after Waldo, you know, after we tried Waldo and all the producers got together again and gone down to LA and we pitched the movie and it's spaced and never responded, and again, I went through this process of trying to get a sequel on it at Universal and failed, and you know, they weren't interested and they were very rude and hostile, and then the economic crash occurred. And I just realized that, wow, the repo outfit, the criminal repo outfit, which Repo Man is about, was based on General Motors Acceptance Corporation. And what happened in the 90s, in the Clinton years, the Democratic regime of Clinton and Rubin deregulated the banks, and they allowed GMAC to become a bank. And so a lot of those bad mortgages and subsequent evictions that occurred when the Depression began were at the behest of GMAC Bank. And we literally, all our tax money went to bail out GMAC. And, you know, instead of, like, poor people losing their cars, poor people being thrown out on the streets by GMAC. And I just thought, man, this has got to be addressed. You know, I cannot just sit around and watch these guys laugh. As our lives are wrecked, you know. And that's why Repo Chick, because of that, there's just this 5-minute thing at the beginning of Repo Chick which talks about GMAC and how they were largely responsible, at least in the United States, for wrecking the economy and throwing so many people into poverty. So that's the reason for it. Everything that comes out of that little documentary is neither here nor there, but it was important to get that little bit out.
All right, well, cheers. Great to talk to you.
Nice talking to you.
Yeah, you too.
Repo Man is available now on Blu-ray from Masters of Cinema, and Repo Chick on DVD from Scanbox Entertainment. If you're an American listener of this show, the director's 1986 Spaghetti Western tribute, now retitled Straight to Hell Returns, is playing at the Texas Theatre Dallas from the 1st to the 3rd of March 2012, and is also available on DVD from www.microcinemadvd.com. To find out more about the other sequel to Repo Man, Waldo's Hawaiian Holiday, and Alex Cox's interest in the comic book medium, please listen to last week's episode of my weekly show on comics, Panel Borders, which you can download from www.panelborders.wordpress.com. That's PanelBorders. Following on from Alex Cox adding CGI blood to the gunfights in Straight to Hell, A similar but subtler addition is one feature of Madam Butterfly 3D, as the cinema director of that has added additional CGI petals to a shot of his film to accentuate the 3D effect, which already enhances the recreation of the experience of going to the opera for people who missed the production or couldn't afford the price of entry. I'm talking to Julian Napier about bringing stereoscopic cameras to the Royal Opera House. The production Madame Butterfly was obviously put on at the Royal Opera House. And at what point did they realise that this was one of the productions that they wanted to film and release in cinemas?
We came to the decision in, I believe it was October of 2010, looking at the season ahead in 2011 and identifying what we thought would be obviously, you know, great popular titles to put out in the cinema. And, you know, you can't really ignore Madame Butterfly. I think it is one of, if not the most popular of operas. It has a very broad appeal. And, of course, you know, Puccini, again, the music is just stunning. And it fitted in, the production itself fitted in very kindly with our filming schedule, where it was sitting in the time of year that it was being brought into the Opera House. So it wasn't really a very difficult choice to make. It was sort of glaring.
And having made that decision, did that affect any of the staging at all? Did you have to light it differently for the version that you shot? Did you have to use a slightly, you know, deeper stage? Or did you actually have to work around the limitations of what already existed in the theatre?
Well, you're always working around. They always pose limits, let us say, because obviously it's nowhere near as flexible as if you were filming this in a studio and you have control over your lighting, the personnel. And indeed your cameras, in terms of being able to stop, start, refocus, you know, retake. Because this is all shot live in front of a live audience, the performance goes ahead. If I miss a bit, I've missed it. There's no going back.
Okay.
And obviously that has to run within the context of a live show and with the... for example, the lighting presets that exist for that show. But what we're able to do, and very kindly with the cooperation of the lighting designer as well, is we have sessions where we can come in to some degree. We can try to balance that lighting so it's a little bit more favourable towards cinema. And that's, you know, our choice of camera, in fact, for shooting Butterfly was very much to do with the fact that, you know, our hands are tied to some extent with lighting. We chose the Alexas because they have a very large dynamic range. They allow us to shoot in low light. So you get, and theatrical light is traditionally, quite contrasty, a lot more so than you would light for cinema. And so they give us the dynamic range, which means that we can sort of cope with some of the problems that theatrical lighting sort of has inherent to it in terms of the way that digital chips and cameras respond.
And how many cameras did you have running simultaneously?
Well, it's filmed over three nights.
Okay.
Three live nights. Two of those evenings are what I call the sort of main event. So I will have four camera rigs. So if you imagine that's four positions, because each position has two cameras because it's shot in 3D stereo. Technically speaking, you have eight cameras overall, but wow. but they're paired together.
Sure.
And they break down as two pedestal cameras left and right of the stage, one Steadicam, which is positioned just inside of the orchestra pit, and a Steadicam, who, you know, gets on and off, is free to move on and off,
sure.
Obviously according to how, we block.
And obviously not getting in the way of the actors as well.
Not getting in the way of the actors, but not getting in the way of the other cameras, because,
Of course.
You know,
yeah.
what's actually sort of one of the most daunting exercises or challenges that it poses filming an event like this in 3D is that 3D really requires you to be close to your subject and shoot on relatively wide angle lenses.
Okay.
Unlike 2D, where you can have seven, eight camera positions horseshoed around the auditorium at the back, which are very unobtrusive, no one's really seeing those cameras. They can shoot from, you know, multiple angles with multiple focal lengths. So you can zoom in and you can get all your close-ups even from the very back of the hall. Well, we can't do that in 3D because when you do that, you actually compress the space. You make everything flat again, which is, you know, obviously counterproductive. That's not what we want to do. So you actually need that proximity. You need those wide-angle lenses. So you're always actually running the risk of having another camera in shot just by virtue of the fact that they have to be close. So it actually takes me about 6 weeks. With Butterfly, it took me about 6 weeks to create the shooting script in such a way that, you know, those cameras are not, you know, one will segue, allow another one, come yield to another. So there's a little sort of ballet that goes on between them so that they're never at any one time in view of one another.
And I guess all the technical aspects of shooting in 3D must be much more difficult than 2D. For example, the focus pulling, in order for the 3D effect to work, must have to be a lot more precise. Do those create greater challenges when you're shooting, particularly in an environment that's already limited to a certain extent?
Well, it is, yes, is the answer. I don't think shooting in 3D doesn't necessarily create more of a focus issue than you would have in 2D.
Okay.
Aside from that, you are shooting through a mirror, a two-way mirror, through which you do lose about a stop of light, which means that you have to open up your aperture, which means you have a shallower depth of field, which means focus becomes more critical. So yes, I guess the answer is, to an extent, that's true. But like anything that is live, you know, it is technically very challenging, and it's a testament to all the crew, the camera crew, the technicians involved in this, that, you know, over two performances, which I call those the main events, where I have those camera rigs, and the third performance is we have one single wide camera at the very back of the hall, which now lets me have, again, to live audience and so on, but that's very unobtrusive. It's behind everything. And that gives me those clean, wide shots without techno cranes and things.
Sure. In it.
But that's one day and one wide angle, and that's it. Go back to the you know, testament to the skill of the technicians involved, because, you know, there's one rehearsal, and obviously we're fully prepared, we're fully briefed, we've gone through this shot by shot, and there's over 700 of them. But these guys are able to execute the shots and the vision, so on, to such an extent that we, out of three performances, we can edit everything together and get an outstanding, very cinematic and beautiful feature-length film.
One thing I think that's really interesting about watching the film is that when people talk about 3D movies, they talk about it being a more immersive experience, and they use some of the terminology of virtual reality as if you suddenly are no longer aware that you're in the cinema. But of course, there's always that black border around the image. With something that's on stage, that almost in a way complements what you're doing, because you're aware of the theatricality of it, that it's almost like you're creating a virtual stage behind the screen. And so that adds in a way to the theatricality of it, because it's almost like you're bringing the theatre to the cinema.
Well, I'm really glad you raised that point, actually, because I think that touches on essentially the nature of these films, is almost that they are a hybrid genre. They're almost creating a new genre, to be honest, in which, you know, in which we are trying to sort of, obviously, we're sort of field testing what the market is for that genre, and everything, and the feedback is very positive. But it's essentially you're creating a filmic experience, but at the same time, it's a simulation of a live experience. Yeah. It's very much part, we're very much aware and conscious of the fact that we don't want to turn this into a self-contained film that is divorced of, you know, the origins, its live origins. It is, you know, we do fundamentally want you to feel like when you're in your seat watching this, that you are experiencing something akin to being there watching this live, although you have the privilege so to speak, of being a lot closer, enjoying the proximity, being on stage, seeing things, subtleties in that performance because of that proximity that you wouldn't have been afforded, you know, at row Z in the auditorium. So it is this sort of fusion of ideas and genres that I think is sort of standing up on its own and does work.
Although bizarrely, there is some CGI in the film, which I wouldn't have known if you hadn't have mentioned it.
I'm delighted that you said that you wouldn't have known it was there because that the whole point is those things work best when you can't identify that. You know, I don't want anyone leveling at me I'd thrown in a sort of cheap gimmick.
You added CGI to accentuate the scene with the petals when Butterfly is preparing for the return of her husband.
The whole point is to be subtle with it. We don't want to draw attention to it. In fact, you know, at no point do you ever really want to draw attention to any of the mechanics of, you know, of what you're doing here, because I don't want to pull anyone out of the story. Mm. That's the biggest, most, you know, the cardinal sin is that the minute you sort of draw attention to what you're doing here and you pull people out of that story, then you've failed in your duties. Mm. But at the same time, I identified that this was a particularly sort of visually poetic moment. Mm. You know, Cho Cho San is preparing her house for the return of her lieutenant and Pinkerton, and she's spraying flowers everywhere. And I just felt that I wanted to, I wanted more empathy. I wanted to sort of put the audience into her POV. So there was an opportunity. There was an opportunity. She's spreading, like, you know, prop flowers, the sort of stage flowers that are practical. But there's an opportunity there to just throw in a few very subtle CGI particles that help sort of it all a bit more immersive.
Mm. I've read that when it comes to editing 3D films, you have to make different decisions because certain juxtapositions of shots actually kind of like confuse your brain when you're looking at them in 3D. Did you find that as you were shooting this? Or because is this the second one you shot after Carmen? Yes. Was the learning experience with Carmen, finding what worked and what didn't work?
Well, very much. I mean, you know, Carmen was the first attempt at all, ever, I think, to capture a full opera in 3D and market it to cinema. And certainly with the techniques or the camera arrays that I was discussing, one could argue that in 2D you can confuse people in terms of crossing
the line and whatnot.
Exactly, in terms of your geography. So the answer is no. It's no more or it's no less critical than it would be in 2D. But yes, there are constraints in terms of how and when you can cut between shots that, you know, it is less of a constraint when you're working in 2D, simply because they're just you have to be very conscious of what you are demanding of the human eye and the whole optic assembly. So again, it's one of those things that I don't want to draw attention to the mechanics. I don't want anything to pull you out of the story. And if I'm not sensitive to some of those issues that happen, what, you know, you're going to feel discomfort, and that's obviously going to pull you out of the narrative. So we, you know, again, we don't want to do that, and we have to be, you know, very sort of conscious of that. And it does dictate sometimes where I can cut. So in two dimensions, yeah, you're not constrained the same. There are occasions in 3D where your hand is forced, but also they're quite simply by virtue of the fact that this is three live shows. A lot of the time, more so than I really care to admit to, my hand is forced in terms of where we have to cut, because as I'm sure you can appreciate, this is not. Filmed in front of a studio with script supervisors and with people in charge of continuity and taking Polaroids of how we left that scene and so on. You know, this is shot live.
And every performance is slightly different.
And I mean, a prime example of that would be where Suzuki's derobing Cho Cho San in the first act, just before they have their big ballad. And of course, you know, Suzuki does that differently every night. You know, this is a little bit of improvisation between the sure. characters, but because I'm quite tight on them, you know, and I'm constantly crossing between different performances here. You know, you end up going, oh, I can't actually cut at this point because, you know, Suzuki's reaching for the comb now. Yeah. In fact, we just saw it in her hair and now it's on the floor. So, you know, you just end up with, there are action continuity issues that constantly force where you can cut.
Well, particularly with an opera with a small cast. If you had more people on stage, you could cut back and forth
That's
between them.
Absolutely fantastic observation. You're absolutely right. Because initially, when we looked at this piece, people were saying to me, oh, you know, this is going to end up being a lot easier to shoot, won't it? Because, you know, it's quite sparse, it's very zen, there's only, you know, 3, 4, 5 characters. And I was like, well, actually, the easiest shots to achieve in Carmen were the big, huge tableaus, you know, when you have, there were times there were about like 100 people on stage. You know, and they're so busy, and it's very easy, therefore, because there's so much going on that, you know, you can get away, because there's so much distraction, you can get away with some of that action continuity. And some of the hardest parts in Carmen were, you know, when I literally had 3 or 4 people on that stage, and those 3 or 4 people would cover the entire, you know, 60-foot width of that stage, and I've literally got like 2 cameras at that point that I can ever film them with, because they'd be so far downstage that I can't film them with anything on the flanks, because it's just too oblique, the angle. So you end up, so I'd only have 2, because when I filmed Carmen, I had 2 techno cranes. So these people would be really far downstage, and I've only got 2 cameras to cover 5 people over a 60-foot wide stage, and you end up tying yourself in knots, and on occasions like that you actually have to throw in the towel and say, you know what, there's only one way to do this, and that is I have to have a different shooting script for those nights. So I get the shots of these characters that I need on performance one, and I'll cover the others on performance two. And you do kind of leave yourself quite vulnerable at those points, because you are relying on those performances being terrific, and there are no issues that you would force you to cut out of those. And so when I looked at Butterfly, I just saw, my God, I got 2 hours and 10 minutes of the same challenge, because that does become, it is actually a lot harder to cover that.
And what next? You'll be looking at the next season at the Royal Opera and thinking, what's populist and what's too much of a challenge?
Well, yes. I mean, we'll start talking, and hopefully we'll identify some more titles, and the adventure will continue. And, you know, we'll continue to reveal, you know, technically what works, and how we can, you know, accomplish even greater things than we have so far. But I think that, you know, we've got an awful lot to be proud of. I think it's a terrific movie, and I hope it turns people into opera.
Me too. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madame Butterfly 3D is released in cinemas throughout the UK on Monday the 5th of March, and you can find out more info about the film at www.madamebutterfly3d.com. In 2D, but no less eye-popping for that, the first of 2012's Electric Sheep events is taking place at the Horse Hospital Club just behind Russell Square Tube Station in London. We're screening Ken Russell's lurid Bram Stoker adaptation, The Lair of the White Worm, starring Hugh Grant, Amanda Donohoe and Peter Capaldi, on Wednesday the 14th of March at 7 p.m. with an introduction by BFI Flipside programmers Vic Pratt and Will Fowler. Tickets are £5, and you can find more info at www.electricsheepmagazine.co.uk/events, where there's also an archive of all our previous podcasts, including my interviews with Wicker Man director Robin Hardy, Texas Chainsaw Massacre director Toby Hooper, Cult Polish director Andrzej Zuwawski, and many more. The Electric Sheep podcast was recorded, edited, and presented by Alex Fitch, and there'll be a new episode online next month. Thanks for listening.